From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. The economy is all about numbers. The daily ups and downs of the stock market, global currencies, interest rates, and your own bank account. But those numbers don't tell the whole story. Today, some new and different ways to measure the nation's and even your own financial well-being. First, though, how much do you know about the people who control your money? I'm talking about Wall Street giants like Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase, central banks like the Federal Reserve, the people who actually make the money.
What the modern central bankers do is exactly what the alchemists were trying to do hundreds of years ago, which is create money out of thin air and influence the economy and the world that way.
Neil Irwin is a Washington Post columnist. He calls these big central bankers the alchemists.
Well, hundreds of years ago, there were these people who thought they could, through potions and magic and early chemistry, find a way to turn ordinary materials into gold or silver. You know, it's been said that Sir Isaac Newton was not the first modern scientist, but rather the last of the alchemists. But what happened around that same time in the 1600s is mankind was figuring out that you don't actually need some potions or magic to create gold or create money where there was none. All you need is a central bank, somebody in charge of it. You need a printing press to create money, and you need the power of the state imbued in that institution. And that allows you to create money out of thin air.
This has been true, then, for a very long time. But for most of us, I think it hasn't been true in an upfront sense until the crisis of 2008 really hit us between the eyes. I would guess that there were people then who'd never heard of Ben Bernanke or Mervyn King of the Bank of England or Jean-Claude Trichet of the European Central Bank. Now, well, maybe people still don't know their names, but they know that there are guys up there who are incredibly powerful.
I think that's true. You know, when things are going well, you take money for granted and you go to the movies and you pay $20 and you get a couple of tickets and everything works normally. What this crisis exposed is how money is really an idea more than a thing. And it can be scary the more you know and the more you think about it. And so what we found during those darkest days of the financial crisis in 2008 was that money was not available. The banks were freezing up lending. The flow of finance, the flow of the global financial system essentially shut down. And what happened is the central banks, these guys, Ben Bernanke and Jean-Claude Trichet and Mervyn King at the Bank of England, they essentially tried to counteract that process. So they fired up the presses. They created money on a vast scale, trillions of dollars in euros and pounds, and flooded the financial system with money to try and counteract this freeze-up in credit that was happening at the same time.
And we trust these people to take care of us. But these are people who are not even elected officials, are they? Maybe that's a good thing. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, society has entrusted these central bankers with a vast amount of power, and it certainly raises concerns from a democratic perspective. You know, why is it that Ben Bernanke, who's a former Princeton professor who's never been elected to anything beyond the Princeton, New Jersey school board, why is that a guy who is able to essentially deploy trillions of dollars that are essentially taxpayer resources, according to how he and his committee see fit? It's a choice that societies have made because the alternatives seem worse. And what we saw again and again through this last several years is that the global central bankers were able to act with a speed and on a scale that the politicians weren't. Presidents and parliaments dithered and tried to move too slowly and too timidly at a time when Ben Bernanke and the other central bankers were willing to, whether it was the middle of the night or whenever it might be, find ways to push these trillions of dollars into the financial system. There are certainly lots of mistakes they made and lots of doubts we can have about individual decisions they made. But in the aggregate, this was something that really kept the world economy from some much worse outcomes.
But it's also interesting, isn't it, that these three men don't actually share the same philosophy. Bernanke is a man who has learned a great deal based on his study of the Depression. But King of the Bank of England would have a completely different attitude under most circumstances, wouldn't he?
Yes, they come from very different traditions, different philosophical approaches, different experiences. Jean-Claude Trichet was a French civil servant. He worked at the French Treasury and became the most powerful central banker in Europe. Mervyn King and Ben Bernanke, they were both academic economists. They actually shared an office at MIT in the early 1980s, but had different impulses and instincts on what to do when things turn bad. So I start the book with this scene of August 9th, 2007. It was really the first day of what became a global financial crisis. And Jean-Claude Trichet is on vacation in France. France. Ben Bernanke has a usual workday in Washington. Mervyn King is off at a cricket match in London for the day. And that's the first time one of the central banks did an intervention. The ECB pumped 95 billion euros into the European banking system. And that day they had all very different philosophies on what was going on, what the threat was, and what to do about it. Now, what we saw is as time progressed, as the threat became graver, as we entered that post-Lehman Brothers time of the fall of 2008 that we all remember some of those dark days, they did find common purpose.
The way you talk about them, the way you've profiled them, the way you describe the work they do, these men seem kind of like Illuminati. What do you think, after this study, of the way they approach their problems, of their ethics?
You know, there are aspects that are a little troubling if you believe in democracy and transparency and all these things. You know, these are the global central bankers. They meet six times a year in Basel, Switzerland, in this cylindrical building next to the train station where that's technically not part of any country. It's like the United Nations. If you go to the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, you are not on Swiss soil, you are on international soil. And they have these long sessions of debating economics. They have a private dinner of just the leading nation central bankers on the 18th floor. They have delicious food and great wine, Bordeaux, Burgundy, good wine. What happens around that table is a sense of common purpose builds, and they feel a loyalty to each other, to the common purpose of trying to shape a better world economy. That said, it does raise lots of concerns if you don't like the idea of a bunch of guys getting together and drinking good wine and charting out the future of all of us. It raises lots of concerns. At the same time, in many ways over the last few years, that process has looked better in its outcomes than what we've gotten out of democratically elected officials. Presidents and parliaments have often been slow up on the uptake at a time the central banks have been more assertive and tried to contain this economic damage.
Of course, the way we look at politics in the United States these days, it almost seems like a benevolent dictator would be a good idea. I'm not proposing that, by the way. Are these men aware of the power they wield?
I think very much so. There is definitely a sense that it is their obligation to try and learn from history, to try and understand where their predecessors have gone wrong. You know, if you look at history, when central bankers fail, societies fail. It was the failures of the German central bank in Weimar Germany that created hyperinflation that led to the initial rise of the Nazis. Then the Great Depression, of course, in the 1930s, that was ultimately a failure of the global central bankers to act with common purpose, to flood the financial system with money, to respond to the actual economic conditions they were facing. The result was an economic depression and, again, the rise of the Nazis in World War II. The stakes here are massive. If they get it right, the world is in a better place. We can avoid a lot of bad things. People can have a prosperous tomorrow and have better outcomes. If they fail, the outcomes can be just horrible.
One of the things people want to know about them, I think, is whether there is any politics involved. We talk about them as though they are independent of politics, and in many ways they are, because they run the economy that fires up the politics. But on the other hand, you've done a lot of study of this, and you've met a lot of these people. You've seen the ramifications. Are there politics? Are they servants at some times of political power?
They try not to be, but they are inevitably chosen by politicians. They serve at the will of democratically elected legislatures. You know, there's a lot of efforts to insulate them from politics by giving them long terms and non-renewable terms, that sort of thing. But at the end of the day, they do operate in a political system. We've seen some very uncomfortable entanglements between political authorities and the central bankers. In Europe, you have the ECB is actually part of this troika of lenders that negotiates with the Greek government and the Portuguese government and the Irish government on what the bailout's going to consist of and what they have to do to get that bailout. So now you have this weird situation where the central bank is essentially dictating to democratically elected legislatures what to do with their taxes and their pension system and so on.
So what do we do to make them better? I mean, is there a way to, I don't know, curtail the privileges, the power of these men in their institutions?
You know, I think the most important thing is accountability. And we already have that in some forms. Ben Bernanke and the others go before their legislatures, their parliaments, and have to answer questions and explain where they're failing, where they're succeeding, and answer essentially through legislators to the public. They all do press conferences now and take questions from reporters. A number of them do speeches where they take questions from the public. I think that is an important element of accountability. They need to have people asking them every day, what did you do? Why did you do it? And second-guessing, are you making the right decision for the masses, not just for the bankers, not just for the financial elite?
Washington Post columnist Neil Irwin. His book is called The Alchemists, Three Central Bankers and a World on Fire.
Money, 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 must be funny. In a rich man's world. Money, money, money.
So do banks really have to rule the world, or is there a better way to think about money and how it does or doesn't make us happy? Steve Paulson is here in the studio with me. Steve's been looking into this question. So what have you found?
Jim, it turns out there are visionaries who are trying to reconceptualize the very nature of money itself. And one of them is Bernard Liotard, who has a fascinating personal history. He was a top official at the National Bank of Belgium and actually one of the people who designed the single currency system in Europe, what became the euro. Liotard wanted to do more, but he was told he couldn't, so he left.
That sounds intriguing. Where'd he go?
Well, he's gone on this fascinating personal journey, leaving the world of mainstream economics. He says what we really need are different kinds of money, what are known as alternative currencies that operate entirely outside the banking system. So Liotard recently teamed up with a journalist named Jackie Dunn to write a book called Rethinking Money. And they stopped by our studio to talk about the problems of single currencies like the U.S. dollar.
We have been trained to believe that you need to do everything with one single tool, that every country needs to have one currency, and that currency will do everything. We have been able to prove that actually that's not true. Number one, we are already in a world where multiple currencies are being used. And number two, the stability of the whole is actually enhanced by having a variety. This is not theory. Switzerland is well known to be a more stable country than its neighbors. And the reason for that is that they've been using a dual currency system now for almost 80 years.
A dual currency system?
Yes.
What are the two different kinds
of
currencies?
Well, you have the Swiss franc, mm-hmm. which everybody knows. And you have a second currency called the WIR, W-I-R, which is a business-to-business currency.
What is a business-to-business currency?
It's a currency created by businesses when they transact with each other. When I sell you something, I have a credit. You have a debit.
I think what's really interesting here, Steve, is how this currency came about. It was way back in the dark days of 1934 in Switzerland, and 17 businessmen got a letter. All of them got a letter from their banks that morning saying, guess what, guys? Your credit line has been stopped. And they sat around with their heads in their hands and saying, good Lord, what are we going to do? And then they realized that they actually all transacted with one another. So rather than going to the bank as they had done traditionally and borrowing money from the local bank, they realized that as they were trading with one another, they could create their own internal currency. And this has kept business doing extremely well in Switzerland for the last 80 years. And about 20% of all business is actually transacted in WIR.
So but let me back up for a moment. What's wrong with just a single currency? It would seem like that's the easiest thing. And that's certainly what most of us are familiar with. I mean, the United
it
States,
is.
There is the almighty dollar. I mean, that would seem to be the money that determines everything. What's wrong with just using that?
It is more efficient. You're correct. But it is more fragile. It's more brittle. Let me explain why. But using the same example of the WIR in Switzerland, if you give a normal business, a Swiss business guy, the choice between 1,000 Swiss franc and 1,000 WIR, he will always take the Swiss francs because with that he can pay his taxes. With that he can take vacations in Mexico and he can buy stuff from China. With the other one, he has to use the credits with 70,000 other businesses in the country. On the other hand, if we're in the recession and everybody's credit has been cut as is happening now, well, then I grab it. So that currency is counterbalancing systemically what happens in the conventional money. If such a system was available in America right now, don't you think there are lots of businesses that actually would like to trade with each other? It's like having a spare tire. It's a stupid idea until you have a flat, right?
So you're not actually saying that there should be an alternative currency that replaces the current monetary system. You're saying there should be additional forms of currency.
Exactly. Other media of exchange than those created by bank debt, which is how dollars are created, and therefore have the capacity to adapt to circumstances of the conventional economy.
There's another way of looking at it. We're talking about having a monetary toolbox. The dollar is brilliant, or the national currencies are brilliant. They were created 400 years ago in a time with a very different sensibility and a very different sets of needs. Today, we're in an information age, a very different age than the industrial age, and we need different currencies to actually address our problems.
And there actually are lots of different kinds of currencies, right? I mean, around the world. I mean, there aren't just a few alternative currencies.
Sure.
I mean, there are hundreds, if not thousands.
There are thousands. Let me start with one example that all your listeners are familiar with. Mm-hmm. Frequent flyer miles.
Okay.
They exist in 40 years. There are two things that it has shown. Number one, it's possible to have very large-scale systems. There are 15,000 billion miles in circulation today. This is not a marginal little thing, at very low cost. If it was expensive, you needed an army of clerks to make this happen, it wouldn't happen. Second point, you can change behavior for a long time. And that's extraordinarily important because we need behavior change now in our society.
In what way has the frequent flyer system changed behavior?
Well, you tend to prefer to take the same airline, don't you?
Sure.
Before that, you didn't. And if it wasn't working, they wouldn't do it, would they?
Okay. And you want to pay with that particular credit card so you can rack up your miles.
There we go. So in other words, it is working in terms of changing behavior. And what a currency does, a complementary currency of that type, is always linking an unused resource, i.e. an empty seat, with an unmet need, i.e. in this case, the need for the airline to get loyalty from you. But just imagine there's a lot of unmet needs in the society and there's a lot of unused resources.
So what are some other kinds of complementary currencies?
Maybe we can describe some stories about how ordinary people, by thinking outside of the box, actually created a solution, a monetary solution to their problems. I think one of my favorite stories, and it's about 25 years old, but it actually goes to the point because it's been so successful, is in Curitiba, Brazil. The mayor at that time had a huge problem of garbage, particularly in the favelas. And he did not have any money. I mean, there was nowhere to go for money. So he did have a bus system that was running a lot of buses that were empty. So he sent out a notice to the favelas and saying to all the children in the favelas, for every bag of garbage they bring in that has been pre-sorted between like paper, cans and glass, they would get a bus token. So lo and behold, within about 2-3 weeks, the favelas were picked clean of garbage. And you can imagine the problems with garbage between rats and diseases, etc. Then the kids had these tokens, which then enabled them and their families to use the bus service. And then local farmers started accepting these tokens in trade for vegetables and fruits that were grown locally.
Hmm. So they weren't just used to ride the buses.
Yes,
then.
It became a currency. Yeah, it actually became a currency. Hmm. The brilliant thing about this is Jaime Lerner, again, an architect and a systems thinker, designed several other currencies. And within about 5 to 6 years, the average person who lived in Curitiba had a standard of living that was 1/3 higher than the average Brazilian living somewhere else. So it's not just this cute little idea. It actually showed up in the bottom line of everybody's paycheck.
You're saying that this all happened just because of the system of bus tokens?
That is what they credited to. Huh. Yes. Another thing that they did is the bus system today in Curitiba is world standard in terms of quality. People with cars don't bother to take the car. They prefer to take the bus because it's faster to get there and you don't have to park at the other end.
How big a city is this?
Well, it must be between 3 and 4 million now.
Oh, so we're talking very big.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, it has grown big.
Yeah. So to talk about some other examples that I read about in your book, in Japan, there's a system of some sort of complementary currency for healthcare for the elderly,
Japan,
right?
Japan is a very interesting case, Steve, because they really hit the wall about 20 years ago about how to deal with the elderly. And again, how would the government come up with the money, you know, to pay for elderly care? So they came up with a system called Furiai Kipu, which takes care of the elderly beyond what they would get in terms of medical care. So how elderly people could actually remain in their homes for longer. So how it works is that I go down the road to my neighbor and I might help her shop or I might drive her to the dentist or write a letter, whatever she needs. And for every hour that I spend helping her out, I get an electronic credit in my Furiai Kipu account. The beauty of this is I can use these electronic credits, say when I've got flu and I need somebody to pick up my kids, or I can save them for when I'm much older and actually need help in assisted living at my own home. Or, interestingly enough, I can transfer it to another part of Japan so somebody can come in and look after my mom. The beauty of this is the elderly that they surveyed love this because people are young, usually younger folks are coming into their home and these intergenerational relationships are forming and this hasn't cost the government anything.
Well, it makes me think that, I mean, just sort of on a much smaller scale, I mean, I know of people, for instance, who have a food sharing system. Mm-hmm. You know, I cook one day of the week and I make a bunch extra for other families and then, you know, I get all these other meals or a babysitting co-op. I mean, those are, that's along the lines of what you're talking about,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Like time banking is the most common system of complementary currencies or community currencies here in the United States. And the reason why, you know, people want to use time banking, it's a way of keeping track of the hours spent doing social purpose things.
Well, maybe we need to back up for a moment and talk about what money is. I mean, it would seem to be obvious. You know, it's a commodity that's exchanged for goods, but you're suggesting it's actually something else.
Yes. Now, in fact, money is an agreement. It lives in the same space as marriage, as a business deal. Okay? It's an agreement within a particular community to use something standardized as a medium of exchange. That's our definition. Now, from that perspective, it becomes possible to make all kinds of agreements.
Is there also a philosophy in these different kinds of currencies? I mean, you know, let's talk about the dollar, for instance. Mm-hmm. It's a very competitive system.
Exactly.
You know, and it's to some degree based on scarcity.
It is.
Are you sort of trying to bring in a different philosophy as to how we think about money?
It's not just a philosophy. It actually is different functionality. And there's sort of two very fundamental thoughts. In all national currency, and all national currencies are the same, whether it's a euro, you know, a peso, or indeed the dollar.
They're created the same way.
They're created the same way, absolutely out of bank debt. And they all have interest. Furthermore, because of interest, they have different functional dynamics, which include the erosion of social capital, the concentration of wealth, short-termism, and competition. Yeah.
So it sounds like what you're really trying to do is to show that there are other kinds of currencies that sidestep the banking system.
Exactly.
And to some degree, the banking system is tied into who has power in society.
We're talking about democratizing money for the first time. And it is becoming possible because of the information age.
Why because of the information age?
95% of all complementary currencies are electronic.
Is this something that's just sort of this whole system of complementary currencies? Are we talking about kind of dabbling around the edges of how we live? Or are you talking about something that could really be central to the way we conduct daily life?
It can change. It will change society. And with the challenges we have to face on this planet during the 21st century, we cannot address it with the tool set of the 17th century.
So you're saying that, I mean, the kind of financial disaster that we've seen over the last decade, well, really since 2007, I mean, you're saying that we'll see more of that.
Oh.
And the only way that we can deal with that is if we have these different currencies?
The IMF, according to their own statistics, show there's been 425 systemic crashes in the last 30 years.
40 years.
40 years, thank you.
Since 1970.
The last 40 years. I mean, that includes, you know, bank crises, which we experienced here in the United States in 2007, 2008. There's been monetary crashes where the actual money system itself, you know, tanked. We're talking about Argentina, for example, talking about the ruble. This is cyclical.
Well, okay, let's play this out a little bit. So, you know, we had this devastating financial crisis in 2007, 2008. Are you saying that these kinds of alternative currencies could somehow stem the impact of that kind of crisis?
They would not necessarily avoid the problem of the system itself, but it would be a buffer, a shock breaker. Yes, we can break the shocks. Similarly, for the social aspects, the aging of society has huge implications in terms of the quality of life of people. And if you try to address these issues with dollars, it won't work. It's just not possible. So you're going to have to either sacrifice that generation or invent new tools. And the Japanese already did. So in other words, the countries that are meeting these problems first are also the ones that are taking initiative in innovating.
Bernard Liotard and Jackie Dunn talking with Steve Paulson. Their book is called Rethinking Money. Coming up, how to be happy with less money. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. There's a great line. It's pretty funny, actually. I've been rich and I've been poor, and believe me, rich is better. I guess the question is whether that's true, and Strange Hems has been thinking a lot about this. Do you think it is?
I think we all think it is. It's funny, that line has been attributed to so many people, from Mae West to Sophie Tucker to Frank Sinatra. I think maybe precisely because that is what we all believe. We all believe we would be quite a bit happier if we had more money. But so what I'm interested in is that this is something that social psychologists and economists have been studying for a decade or so now. And the data consistently shows, in America at least, that up to a certain point, more money does make people happier, at least a little happier, but there's a ceiling. And once your annual income hits about $75,000, making more money actually has absolutely no impact on your day-to-day level of happiness.
Why, it's counterintuitive. No one would believe that. So after a certain point, money can't buy happiness?
Well, that's where the new science of spending comes in. So, for instance, there are these two behavioral scientists, Michael Norton at the Harvard Business School and Elizabeth Dunn at the University of British Columbia, and they've done these studies that show over and over again how you spend your money, what you spend it on, can have a significant impact on how happy you feel.
Well, for one thing, people pour lots of money into material things, but research suggests that it's actually better to buy experiences.
That's Liz Dunn.
For example, people get more lasting happiness from things like vacations, special meals, concerts, than from couches, televisions, things that surprisingly stick around. Ironically, don't actually provide us lasting happiness.
Now, why would that be? Because, for instance, you would think if somebody buys the house of their dreams, they're going to live in that house for, I don't know, 40, 50 years, whereas a vacation might be only 2 weeks.
Right. Well, the funny thing about stuff like houses is that because it sticks around, we get used to it. We are blown away at first by, say, the new marble countertops or the beautiful hardwood floors, but soon just becomes kind of the wood beneath our feet that we don't really notice. Whereas vacations, although they come to an end, we're likely to actually see them even more positively as time goes on.
So this is good news probably for travel agents and hotels and resorts and companies that market anything having to do with travel. Not so much good news for companies that create products.
Right, although interestingly, when you think about it, many products fall somewhere along the continuum from something that's clearly a material thing to something that's clearly an experience. So, for example, a sofa is clearly a material thing. A trip to Paris is clearly an experience. But what about, I don't know, the new wetsuit that I bought this weekend? It's a material thing, but what it allows me to do is stay in the freezing cold Canadian water surfing. And it turns out that if you can actually think about a material thing in terms of the experiences that it provides, you're more likely to get lasting happiness from that thing.
Are there any big ticket items, products that actually are worth the money in terms of the happiness they provide?
Well, I would say purchases that really fundamentally change the way we spend our time can make a real difference. For example, one of the worst things you can possibly do with your time is commute. So taking a job with an hour-long commute has an effect on happiness that's equivalent to not having a job at all. And being unemployed is terrible for happiness. So moving closer to work could actually be an effective route to increasing happiness.
Now, you've also done some research suggesting that we use money to buy time. Can you explain what you mean?
The idea here is that before you reach for your wallet, you should try to ask yourself, will this purchase change how I spend my time? But many of the products that we buy, many things that I myself find very tempting, you know, when I walk into Kate Spade and see a really cute new dress that I want, I have to kind of stop and ask myself, okay, is this actually going to change the way I spend my time? And the answer is probably not. And I would argue that if a product isn't going to have a positive impact on the way we spend our time, it might not be worthwhile.
But that sort of suggests that, I don't know, the people who spend money on house cleaning services are happier than people who scrub their own bathrooms?
I think that house cleaning services are a great use of money. My husband likes to say that, you know, although our tiny little kitchen could fit on a ship, it takes me like 45 minutes to clean it. And so for me, hiring a house cleaner is actually a good use of money. There are people, strangely enough, who I know who enjoy cleaning. Now, this is totally foreign to me, but for them, I wouldn't recommend paying for a house cleaner because the time that they spend cleaning is almost like meditational time for them. So I think the overall principle that I think is supported by science is that we should use our money to improve the way we spend our time. The nature of that improvement, of course, idiosyncratically depends on people's own particular preferences.
Well, and I guess the point being that there can be hidden time costs to certain purchases. Somebody who spends the money to get an in-ground pool, they might think, oh, I'm going to be so happy. The kids and I are going to hang out and swim every day, except then they've forgotten how much extra maintenance time it's going to take.
Absolutely. So one thing that we suggest is that people apply what we call the Tuesday test. And the question is, how will this purchase change the way I spend my time next Tuesday? So this very simple test turns out to de-bias our predictions about how much something will impact our happiness. When we think about buying a pool, for example, we're likely to kind of by default, imagine like that once a summer pool party where we gather the whole extended family and have a wonderful barbecue and make margaritas and it's all wonderful. And what we forget is that on the typical Tuesday, what we're going to be doing is rushing home from work to clean the pool. We're not actually going to have time to swim in it. And so thinking about what our time is actually like on just a typical average day can be very helpful in weeding out those purchases that might have little impact or even a negative impact on our happiness.
So, Liz, I'm curious, all this stuff makes a lot of sense, but why don't we know this ourselves already?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I mean, I think part of the problem is that it's really hard to understand what has a positive impact on our own happiness. I mean, we're faced with so many temptations. I know this research better than anyone, and still I find myself, you know, eyeing that dress at Kate Spade and thinking, this is going to make me really happy. It's a tough thing to really, A, recognize what's going to make us happy, and then B, act on that recognition on a day-to-day basis. So even if you think, okay, you know what, I'm going to buy more experiences, in the moment, it's very easy to get sucked into the concrete features of an appealing material thing. The appeal of experiences tends to be somewhat more abstract. And, you know, abstract ideas are often vulnerable to more concrete ones when we're making a decision in the moment.
Yeah, the other thing I'm thinking about is that, you know, the line in the American Constitution, we all have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Turns out pursuing happiness is a lot harder than we think. Or more complicated than we think.
Right. I think it's a complicated pursuit. And, you know, researchers are just beginning to recognize just how complicated this topic really is. But I think it is a topic that yields itself to science that we can pick apart and try and figure out, okay, what really makes people happy and offer at least some broad guidance that people can then apply in their own lives.
Elizabeth Dunn is the co-author with Michael Norton of Happy Money: The Science of Smarter Spending. And Strange Chimps talked with her.
Say you don't need no diamond ring and I'll be satisfied. Tell me that you want those kind of things that money just can't buy. I don't care too much for money can buy me love. Don't want money.
Speaking of the economics of happiness, well-being. In 2010, Great Britain became one of the first countries in the world to create a national measure of well-being, a gross national happiness index. Britain's one of the centers of the new happiness economics, thanks in large part to the work of Lord Richard Layard, an internationally renowned economist. Steve Paulson caught up with him at a recent conference on global well-being.
Lord Richard, you were one of the first economists to study happiness. Why would an economist even want to work on this strange subject of happiness?
Well, actually, the people who founded economics, you know, in the 18th century, Adam Smith, those sort of people, thought that what they were doing was trying to find out what conditions, what social arrangements, what economic arrangements were conducive to the happiness of the people. Well, you know, Thomas Jefferson said that was the only point of government. So it's not a new idea in economics, but I think what went wrong was that economists began to doubt their ability to interpret whether people were happy or not. And they thought, well, the only thing we can be sure of is if they've got money in their pockets.
Mm. So economics really became more a matter of measuring prosperity, right? I mean, that was considered the sign of success.
That's what happened to it. And we got to this extraordinary situation where the gross national product became the sort of talisman of virility of a country. And of course, the evidence then accumulated over time from the 1950s onwards. In the States, which was the first country where happiness was being measured systematically, it wasn't growing, although the people were becoming very much more rich.
So income was rising, but happiness was not rising.
Yeah, yes. By the 70s, people were saying, why is this? And they found that probably the main reason was that people were measuring their happiness against some standard, some norm, and the norm probably being mainly what other people had. And there's now a huge amount of evidence that people assess their income in large part relative to the income of other people.
I think this is a really important point to make. So you're saying it's not absolute income that really matters so much in terms of people's happiness. It's how well we're doing next to the other guy. It's how we stack up. And if it seems like the other guy is getting ahead, then we're not going to be as happy.
Yeah, so this is, if you like, a zero-sum game because, of course, it's impossible for one person to become relatively richer without somebody else becoming relatively poorer. And if you actually look at the causes of happiness, you will find that a tiny part of it is due to their relative income, actually not much more than 2%. But we can explain something like a third of it by other factors, the most important external factors being the human relationships, especially, of course, in the family, but also whether you have work, what your work is like. But even more important, actually, the internal factors. And mental health is the dominant internal factor. And physical health, of course, becomes very important later in life. But during working age, mental health is the single most important determinant of a person's happiness.
When you talk about mental health, you're talking about not being overly angry. I mean, what are the factors?
I'm talking about mental illness, meaning depression or quite specific anxieties, obsessive compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress, these kinds of disorders. These account for something like, at the clinical level, 16% or so of a population. And one of the conclusions that I've come to is that, you know, if we were thinking about how a society should be organized better to promote happiness, one of the most obvious things is that we should be spending much more on providing psychological therapies for people with depression and anxiety disorders. These are quite effective treatments now.
Hmm. So you're saying from a public policy perspective, I mean, one thing that a country really could do to enhance the well-being of its population is to get more people into therapy so that they feel better.
Yes, not endless psychoanalysis where the evidence of its effects is quite limited, but these short therapies like cognitive behavioral therapy with thousands of randomized trials that show their power. These are the things that ought to be relatively liberally provided by insurance systems around the world. So you've got this extraordinary situation where, for example, depression is a much more debilitating condition than diabetes. Depression, anxiety disorders are accounting for something like 40% of all absenteeism, if you're thinking of it from the employer's point of view. And yet, 90% of people with diabetes are in treatment, and not more than a third of people with depression, even severe depression, not more than a half. I mean, this is absolutely shocking.
Well, so then to return to our first question, what does an economist bring to this study of happiness as opposed to, say, a psychologist or a psychotherapist? Yeah. You're saying that there are public policy implications here?
Yeah, I think there are two things that an economist brings. First, he brings this idea that you should allocate resources, money, on the basis of the benefits that you can get per unit of money spent. So the question is, how do you measure the benefits? Now, economists who have become enslaved to the gross national product will measure the benefits in purely money terms, output. But that is not, of course, a proper measure. The right measure is the extra happiness produced and misery relieved.
And you can actually measure happiness.
And this is what we can now measure.
It sounds like what you're saying then is that really the bottom line for what economics should focus on is maximizing happiness for the greatest number of people, the classic utilitarian argument.
That is what it should be. The other thing I think where economists are quite good is in thinking seriously about the questions of cost. Now, if you look at, for example, the net cost to the provider, say the healthcare system, of providing psychological therapy, well, what is it? Obviously, the gross cost is the cost of employing the therapist, but the net cost has got to take into account the savings which will come about because a person who is less depressed, less anxious, goes to the doctor less often for physical problems. Even though they're getting the extra cost of psychological therapy, they cost the insurance system less in total because they go to the doctor less for physical illnesses.
Now, you've said that GDP is the wrong measure. This is not the sign of success of a culture. So I guess the question is, what is? If GDP is not the answer, what should be the bottom line measurements that a government should be trying to achieve on behalf of its people?
Oh, I think whether people are satisfied with their lives. And this is now what has been introduced in Britain. We now have a regular annual official government survey of how satisfied people are with their lives. The OECD, the Club of Rich Nations, including the United States, has produced a manual published this year of standard ways of measuring it.
So the question then is, will political leaders actually pay attention to the results of these well-being surveys?
Yeah. Well, there is a lot of support in many countries. I was just invited last week to go and meet with Mrs. Merkel, which
in Germany.
Surprised me. Mr. Sarkozy, of course, started it off in France. England has perhaps gone faster than any other country so far, but there's interest in every country, I would say, and it does require, of course, the political leaders to pick it up and run with it.
Richard Layard is the director of the Well-Being Program at the London School of Economics Center for Economic Performance, and he's the author of the book Happiness: Lessons from a New Science. In 2012, he co-edited the World Happiness Report. Steve Paulson talked with him. Coming up, if economies had seasons, it would be winter right now. Question is, when will it be spring? I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Rebecca Ryan is a generational expert, an economist and futurist who consults for businesses and local governments on generational change. She's particularly interested in the so-called millennials, the generation born between 1980 and 2001. Millennials have been hit pretty hard by the recession. The job market dried up just as many of them were beginning their careers. So Rebecca Ryan told Anne Strangechamps that what's going on is bigger than an economic downturn. It is a fourth turning, the end of another cycle of American history. What few of us realize, she says, is that America goes through seasons, and right now we are in winter.
Exactly. In fact, you can go back to the beginning. So our first winter was the American Revolution. And what happens during winter is everything that felt certain is just completely uncertain. And so we've had three other winters, the American Revolution, Civil War and Reconstruction, and then the Great Depression. And now my premise is that we're in our fourth winter.
So what is a winter? What makes a particular period of time a winter?
Well, things feel very up in the air and uncertain. So the things you were always able to bank on, my home will always increase in value, are just not certain anymore. You know, getting an education means I will have a great job, not certain anymore. So those are some of the micro things that you can look at. But also, just there tends to be a lot of political ripping of hair and gnashing of teeth. And we certainly are seeing that. And we saw that in our previous three winters.
Now, the three periods of time you mentioned, the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, the Great Depression, I mean, those were some of the biggest, most catastrophic periods in American history. They were massive crises. Are you saying you think we're in another one of those?
I do think we're in the midst of winter. And although when you look back on those periods, you or I might think, this is easy street compared to that, I think we will look back on this period and some of the decisions we've made, and we will realize that we turned a corner. And during this period, America will either emerge working better for more people or not. And that's the corner we've turned in every previous winter.
How long do these cycles tend to last? Like, if you look back in history,
can
you predict when we'll get out of this one?
I knew you'd ask that question. Every other winter period has lasted, on average, 19.67 years. So if we place the start of winter, our current winter, at 2001, we'll be out of it by about 2020.
Oh, that's only in 7 years.
Piece of cake.
It's a long time, but on the other hand, we're more than halfway through it. More than halfway. Huh. So it sounds like the big advantage of seeing American history in terms of seasons is, as we said, that you can look back at other dark periods, other winters, and say, okay, so how did they get from winter to spring?
That's really what I wanted to get out of studying America's previous winters. And there are some lessons to apply. And I think, you know, one of the big ones, we're in the middle of it right now, is overall during these periods, America always questions itself. Who is America for? And what is America for? So when you start seeing more gay athletes coming out, when you start seeing more states allowing gay marriage, America is very clearly saying who it is for.
Or look at the huge debate right now over undocumented immigrants.
And what's interesting, I mean, if you really look back, previous winters usually have the seeds for the next winter in them.
Oh.
So, for example, I'm just going to geek out on you historically for a moment. Already during the American Revolution, when the Declaration of Independence was inked and then, you know, we had our new Constitution, the founding fathers were beginning to question whether America was only for European settlers or whether America also should expand rights to include formerly African slaves. So already the seeds for the Civil War were planted in our Constitution.
So what would you say, if you're going to then look ahead into the future, what seeds do you see now that you think, let's see, what would this be like 30 years from now, we might really have intense debate over?
I think one of the things that is being planted now that I feel concerned about for our next winter is, as America ages and at the same time as we become a country that is less Caucasian, I think we are staring at a showdown between older white Americans and younger non-white Americans. Actually, I really think one of the big questions is going to be whether our oldest citizens will vote for the next generation that doesn't look as much like them.
Now, you study generations and generational differences, and I noted that you said that the generation that is born in one season comes of age in the next season.
That's right.
So how does that play out? Because there's always that feeling of disappointment. You know, everything that you grew up with in one season changes just as you come of age. It sounds like we've seen that pattern over and over again.
Yeah, and the generations stack up in that way. So if you're born in spring, you know, as a boomer, you were born in spring, you came of age during the youth revolution, the summer, you came into middle management or the height of your career, your highest earning power, as things were starting to decay and get very uneven. And now you're going to head into your elderhood in winter. And for younger people, and I truly, the reason I wrote this book is because I saw my peers. I'm a Gen Xer, and I work with a lot of millennials, and I saw the people who I see as the future leaders of this country, I saw them getting the keys to the car at the very time that there was a blizzard going on and people were saying, like, good luck, you know. So I wrote this book to kind of help steer through this a little bit, to say, hey, guys, we've been here before. Here's what we've learned. Here are the things that we're going to have to solve on our watch. And I really believe that we can do it. And here's how I think we can do it.
So part of the message is, there's nothing really you can do about winter, right? I mean, it's going to happen. And one message could be you just hunker down and, you know, endure it. But it sounds like you're saying no, now is when you need to prepare, because you know there's going to be a recovery. You know there's going to be a spring. So think ahead to what conditions we need to try to create for the generation that's going to come of age during that spring. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. I feel like those of us who are alive at this moment owe it to our kids and our grandkids and theirs to make really wise decisions. We only cycle through winter every 100 years or so. And the decisions that are made in winter, the laws that are passed in winter, set the table for what our kids and grandkids inherit. So we have to choose wisely. One of the things that people can look for, because you might be thinking, well, how will I know when spring is really here? You know, and so the metaphor I like to use, and maybe it's because I'm a Midwesterner, but we really have hard seasons in the Midwest. Spring is very clear, summer and so forth. And in the Midwest, winter, it might seem like things are dead, but they're just frozen and cold, and squirrels and bears are hibernating, and they all come back out in the spring. And what they've been doing through winter is they've been regathering their energy. They've been sort of shoring up. And that's some of what we need to do. We need to just sit still for a second and say, what do we really care about? And how do we line our resources up behind that? And another thing to look for is, in the book, I have this diagram. It's an XY diagram. And on the X-axis is a spectrum from me, myself, to we, us. And on the Y spectrum is from hope on the top to fear on the bottom. And what you will start to see happen as spring comes again is we as a country will begin moving from me mind, which is very scarcity minded, very recession minded. How am I going to take care of me and mine? Over to we mind. So we'll move back over and we will start moving from fear back up to hope. So
sounds good to me.
Yeah, sounds good to me too. And if the past is prologue, that will be what you'll start to see as spring comes again. And I feel like some of the signs are already there. You mentioned a couple of them before, you know, gay rights and the discussion about immigration. Those are signs that we're saying that America is for more people.
Is there a big question for you in all of this, sort of an overarching philosophical question that you arrive at when you look at American history in terms of seasons?
Yes. When I did the research for the book, I came out of the first draft of the book feeling very depressed. So I think the philosophical question for me is, how do we, you and I and all of us, bring active hope to this exercise of winter? Because a lot is being asked of us right now, those of us who are alive in this moment, and our kids and grandkids are going to depend on us. So the challenges are huge, bigger than any of us have seen in our lifetime because of the seasonal nature of this. And how do we bring a sense of hopefulness to that?
Rebecca Ryan is a futurist and the founder of Next Generation Consulting. She and Anne were talking about her new ebook, Regeneration. We'll provide a link for it on our website at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to listen again, or share an interview maybe with a friend, or sign up for our podcast, you can find out all about it on our website, ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Anne Strainchamps, with help from Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Charles Monroe Kane. Thanks to TT Book listener Peter Serla for this week's theme remix. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.